So today I'm here with Scott Ruick, who is one of the founders of NetBlue, which today is merged with Vendari and is now Connexus. And so Scott's going to share a little bit about the story of how they got going and how it all happened, and also tell us a little bit about getting funding and about buying companies. So Scott, you want to give us a very brief intro and we'll get going?
Yeah, thanks for having me. I appreciate the time. I was preface these types of things by saying how fortunate I am to be in space. I think it's a great space that I fell into almost by accident. And I was lucky enough to be early stage in companies and see how the industry's progressed over the last 6 years, 7 years or so. I'm really happy to be part of the space.
So, it was you and Ken Chen that originally got NetBlue started, and it had different names before it really got going. You want to tell us a little bit about how you initially got started and sort of how it evolved? I mean, was it the two of you just working out of the basement?
Ken and I first got involved when I was involved with Matterlord. He was in the early stages building a company called Roughly DVDs, which was a company that was in the business of giving away DVDs for consumers and taking a variety of different actions. And he got that going, especially with not a lot of money, added his room to the day. And, we met on that basis. I was lucky enough to come in very, very early in the company's development. We were very young. We had probably a total of about 4 or 5 people in the company at the time. My first desk was, an IKEA plastic desk out of his office's bedroom. I had a 3-month-old little girl and a lot of reasons to succeed. And so that's kind of the beginning of it.
So Ken basically started, you were working at another company called Meta Reward, and Ken got things going then with what became NetBlue. He came to you and said, hey, do you want to come on board? And I would imagine, was that because of your media buying capability? And then, so you then joined and then were working out of his office / house on the plastic table, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, that's what, guy. I mean, in the position that I was at Meta Reward, being one of the earlier affiliate networks, I was privy to a lot of successful marketing techniques that I saw manifest themselves through the affiliates that I had that I was working with. And so I was able to understand, why people were making money, how they were doing it, as I was promoting many of the offers through them. And so I think what Ken saw in me was an ability to see what was the most successful marketing technique for at that time. Meta Reward didn't really buy media per se, but we really had a lot of interaction with very high quality, great clients to help us understand, what was working, what wasn't working. So I think until I met was the fact that I've always considered myself an entrepreneur, and I had a lot of valuable expertise on how to make your campaigns that much more successful.
Right. So Ken had some campaigns running. You had the experience on how those work, so you jumped in and helped him make those run better.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, I think early people back in the space in 2001, 2002 were trying a number of things, and so I was just fortunate enough to kind of be able to peek behind the curtain to see what was actually working and converting, not just because Meta Reward had a site called Netflix, which in essence was doing something very similar to cash, but also I can see best practices from the, thousand affiliates that we acquired over a period of time, so I can understand who was doing what and how they were doing it and get a better insight into how Ken could be successful.
So when you came up with some of the sorts of things that you started helping with?
Well, when we started, we didn't have a lot of media buying. I mean, we were really doing some affiliate network media buying through Phonefly Commission Junction, and really we began in earnest to get distribution for the offers, which at that point in time, we were giving away DVDs to consumers for doing a variety of actions. And so, the first order of business was to expand distribution. So what we did was, I took my contacts and we began to grow the business by expanding distribution. One of the key things we did, and I think we were one of the first to do it, was really get distribution through other affiliate networks by helping them promote their offers. And that may not sound, I can rephrase that in a way that may make more sense, but the main source of distribution for us back in the day was Attractive. Attractive both became a place where we advertised, and we also became a publisher of Attractive. So, we kept coined the term private offer network, where they were heavily promoting our offers to their affiliates. In return, the offers that we promoted on the page were all theirs. So it really helped them on two fronts. It helped them earn margin on a in such a way that they were promoting our offer to other affiliates. And similarly, we were driving off the volume to their advertisers, such as Columbia House, Netflix, these kinds of folks. So hopefully that makes sense. If not, email me. Anyone can email me and I can explain in more detail how that actually got to the ground. But that was our first big success in terms of distribution.
So let me see if I can hear here. You're then, like you're taking offers out of someone's network or offers for a publisher. You're running those offers as part of what you're doing for NetBlue, and then you're getting them to help you drive that traffic. So they're getting commissions on you driving traffic for them, as well as commissions on the offer that you're driving at the same time. Maybe that's not a very clear explanation, is it? Does that make sense?
You absolutely got it, Adrian. And one of the things that it allowed them to do was present our offer, which was, in those days, it was typically $1.25 commission or email submit. That moved into a margin to their publishers because they were then making up the volume by us doing offers through Columbia House. So, usually our ad network, the offer that we promoted came out very high because Adtractive decided to take a little bit of the margin quite wisely. And so, we got an awful lot of distribution, and in return, we promised that any leads that came through the door would all be redirected toward their back-end advertiser. So, we kind of coined the term private offer network. And so that relationship really, drove the way to a lot of similar type distribution arrangements down the road.
How are you making money on that? What kind of money is in that for NetBlue?
Well, when I left NetBlue, or
I'm talking about, I guess, you getting started with this. So you're basically grouping a bunch of offers together at the same time, and then driving traffic to them all, and then customers are picking out the offer that they like the best. That then, because the customer selected that, they lead to an overall higher effective CPM. Is that correct?
Yeah, I mean the model really worked. I mean, you know, we played with it quite a bit. We incentives and offer types, but you know, in general, a lot of work. We were finding that we were distributing the offer for, you know, anywhere between $1 to, you know, $2, and effectuating, you know, north of $2 to $3. So, you know, when we could figure out the correct mousetrap that elicited the consumer response we wanted, the main issue at that point became scaling it. And so that leads me to, you know, the second area where we really scaled was we were one of the first guys to really embrace CPM advertising. What we found was even back in those days, there was heavy competition for these types of offers. And so nobody at this point began to seriously contemplate doing CPM buying because, the onus becomes on you at that point. In other words, if your trade doesn't work, you lose, not the publisher, on a CPA basis. So, you know, that began a relationship, CPM buying. We started off with Microsoft, probably in 2003 with a $10,000 campaign buy. And then somewhere done, they're probably spending $700,000 a month over a period of a few years.
And so when you did that first buy, how did that work out? You spent $10,000, what did you get back?
Well, you know, what's interesting about Microsoft was back in the day, I mean, they were commonly viewed as the most difficult to work with. But in this example, they had a program called P+, which allowed guys like us, which they believed in, to operate kind of on a modified CPA basis. So, you know, that was really surprising to us because, you know, the common perception that Microsoft, and particularly Hotmail, was very, very difficult to work with. I think, large degree, our success predicated itself on having a sales rep that had been there for a number of years and knew the space. And so, you know, the $10,000 I'd buy, we got crushed. We got crushed for the first 6 months of the relationship. No, I don't say 6 months. I did probably 3 months, we got crushed. But one of the things that I appreciate what Ken did so much was he set the mandate that if we were going to succeed as a company, we had to be the ones that embraced and consumed CPM advertising, or we died. So the entire company rallied around embracing CPM advertising, what that meant. It meant that you had to be a creative organization. You had to get banners that click. You know, you had to watch the campaigns much, much differently than if you were doing a CPA campaign. So, you know, we had hands with Microsoft early on, and we lost a little, and they gave us a chance, and that relationship really grew up quite nicely over the years.
So the fact that you got embraced CPM early on, that was a critical thing. Had you not done that, NetBlue wouldn't have become NetBlue.
Yeah, no, there's no doubt in my mind, Adrian. I mean, there's any number of smaller, incentive-based sites that have done, you know, okay, but, you know, our ability to really scale and change the game was predicated on the idea of buying media differently than everybody else. And it was a big risk, but what we found was once we did it predictably, you know, other companies joined suit. You know, if we're buying $200,000 a month on Dashboard on a CPM basis, you can imagine that our competitors, would like to bump in there as well, and they did. With everything online, most things online, the numbers are very apparent to most people, and seeing how things work or don't work becomes, if you have the right eye for it, a lot easier than most people think.
So how long after you guys started working heavily at CPM that other people came in?
You know, not too much longer. I'd say, you know, the one that came in the quickest was a gentleman named Nunu, who ran the Useful. So, you know, as we began to scale up on places like Fast Click and types of places, I think he took me out very quickly and began to emulate our model quite successfully, actually. You know, I would say it was no more than a few months before we began to see similar campaigns, and I mean similar, almost very similar, extremely similar campaigns show up alongside our campaigns on places like Fast Click, which we had really been able to scale in addition to the Microsoft campaign.
And so this was also around the time when CPM rates had dropped because of the dot-com implosion and all that sort of stuff. So you were then coming in. The publishers were saying, no, screw this. Even though we're getting low CPM rates, we don't care. We're not going to do CPA. And so there was kind of a void, which you guys then came in. And, is that correct?
Yeah, I mean, we became proficient, I think, the three main ways that things are priced online, CDA, CPC, and CPM, we became proficient at both types of bonds. You're absolutely right. I mean, I think, there weren't a lot of advertisers, quite frankly, advertising on a CPM basis. So while these publishers had massive amounts of inventory, they were holding as steady as they could to keep their rate card. But if you know who to talk to and you knew how to navigate yourself around organizations like Microsoft or Yahoo or any one of these places, you'll find ways to buy Reddit inventory exceedingly expensive. And so we were also one of the things that we did was we were able to put up large dollar amounts. Many of these bigger sites we found that were quite frustrated dealing with smaller ad buys, such as 5K or 10K. So we realized this was a defensibility position, so we were able to things like 50K or 100K, and therefore get all that inventory and box out our competitors. So, you hit it. I mean, there's a lot of cheap inventory back in the day, and I think I see something similar now with places like Facebook and MySpace generating massive amounts of inventory every day. A lot of cheap inventory out there.
You gave the example of Yahoo. So let's say someone off the street wants to go and start buying volume on Yahoo. You're saying back then they were getting tired of getting approached with 5 to 10K buys. So your approach would be to come in and give Yahoo a $50,000 check to get started, or like how would you get things rolling?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, we were able to successfully explain to them our buying position over places like our competitor, Microsoft and Hotmail, and we were willing and able to do a large dollar amount. So we, at one point, struck a year deal with Yahoo for, I think, in the neighborhood of $500,000 or $600,000. And, when you talk in terms of those amounts, you get people interested, you get people listening to you. The challenge they had was a lot of inventory and a lot of small CPM buys of $5,000 and $10,000, which really didn't move the ball. So we wanted to make put a stake down and say, we're willing to invest a lot of money, but it's going to be, it's going to be a price or rate and a positioning that makes sense to us. So that was, I think that helped us quite a bit in terms of being able to scale the kind of business we were doing.
And so you come, what would you start with as an initial buy with Yahoo? How much would you get started with them?
I think we probably started at 25 or 50K. We had a good understanding of what creatives work, what sites, what campaigns work, the type of prices we should be paying, the type of clicking rates we could expect. So, we walked in with an awful lot of knowledge, and you're quickly able to ascertain based on placement, based on creator type, campaign that works versus don't work. And so if you have built that infrastructure to be able to do that, you're able to quickly turn around and take unprofitable campaigns and make them profitable. So, I think we probably started on Yahoo Mail, buying, 88 by 31 or 468 by 60s. And then, as you make those placements and those campaigns successful, you go on to other parts of Yahoo. We even, I think, purchased a one-day homepage on Yahoo buy for $20,000 or $30,000, at some point. So I think that, I think that's how we started.
And so that's the point. What percentage of your traffic was coming from CPA versus CPC versus CPM?
CPC for us was always pretty light. I think more recently we've done more volume. But back in, 2004, 2005, I'd say that probably there's a good stretch where probably 60 to 70% of our lives were on a CPM basis, and probably 30% was on a CPA basis. But we really wanted to embrace CPA advertising as a way to move forward. I think publishers take you seriously. They take care of it. They think you're a more serious buyer if you're doing CPM buying versus CPA. And so we wanted to be treated that way.
So what were you using to do all your ad serving on?
Well, we didn't have a lot. I mean, I know literally in the development we used Fast Click System, but I mean, generally put, we relied heavily on the publishers ad serving system. So a typical campaign would be if we had a Yahoo buy on Yahoo Mail, and the placement was a 468 by 60, we would get over to them 10 pieces of creative, and we would target them all and track them all separately through a proprietary service we had. They would serve them. And as they served them, the data came in, we would, create these spreadsheets that looked at impressions and clicks and click-throughs and landing page submissions and how far they got in our path and tended to tie revenue to those various bits of the path, and then back into what ended up being either a profitable or unprofitable campaign. The unprofitable ones, we had a plan of action to mitigate our losses, so we would change the creative, we would go to a lower price, and that was the game we played.
And so you analyze it all against the numbers all the way through and then do what works. And you said you were using some proprietary tools. Did you write your own ad server to serve this stuff and track it?
No, we didn't have so much ad serving. We had really reporting. A gentleman named John Frisby, who is, I consider him to be quite a genius in the space,
really built the reporting system that I think even probably still exists today at WorkNexus. But he was able to build a system that gave us the ability to track just about any number of events as they happened. So I knew when a user hit my page, I know where he came from, the campaign, the page. We would scroll through multiple landing pages in an effort to get the highest conversion. So he basically built a tool that allowed us to do what we did on the media buying side.
So then you had this company, you had things going, you guys had made the eyes to do CPM buying. That's working, money's coming in, you know you've designed a model that's scalable. And at what point did you then decide to go and raise money to grow the business?
Well, it was interesting, because it seemed like there was a shift in the venture community where many of them all of a sudden began to look at lead generation and realize how much money we were all making. But I mean, it was odd, you know. In the course of a week, we probably had three different venture capitalists knocking our door, where before we hadn't seen or heard from anybody. So, you know, the space all of a sudden got very, very hot, and we looked around, we interviewed a number of different venture capitalists, and tried to figure out what we could do with money and where we could expand to. And I credit Penn with really being able to tell the story of what NetBlue did and where it was going. And so, at some point through a period of time, we decided to take venture capital and scale the business accordingly.
So why did you decide to do it that way? Why not just, it's lead generation, there's money in it, it's a profitable business right from the start. Why not just scale it up and then own the entire business itself? Why did you make the decision to raise funds?
Well, I think, you know, there's a long tradition in the Valley of companies raising money and being able to do much, much larger thing outside of just a couple entrepreneurs working out of an office. I mean, we, like many entrepreneurs, bought in on the idea that, venture allows you to scale much, much quicker than your competitors. So you're in a very competitive spot. You can choose to end up being 100% owner of a $5 million a year business or a 20% owner of a $50 million a year business. So, you know, we believe that by taking venture capital, we could both attract the kind of talent we thought we needed to expand the business. We would have cash in the bank to make purchases or make key acquisitions or invest in projects we thought were worthwhile. We were able to attract the different type of talent. Venture-backed companies tend to, let's just say, get more serious attention. And also, you know, the belief that the venture guys are out there actively trying to help your company. So they bring a Rolodex of people that they think would benefit your company, and they're thinking of exits and all kinds of interesting things while you're building the business. So it helps from a lot of different angles.
And do you think in hindsight that you needed it?
You know, we didn't need it, right? I mean, we were running a successful, profitable, small business. We probably had at that time about 20 or 30 employees. So we clearly didn't need it. I think we wanted it, though. I mean, we took a look at what was being offered to us and decided that was the best way to go. I mean, we clearly could have made the decision to run our company in a way that we thought was best and keep it small and grow that business. But I think Ken, myself, and a gentleman named Derek Phillips decided that we were going to make a bigger run at it and try to do something bigger than just the three of us. So that was the bet we made. I'm sorry.
How much money did you raise?
We raised $20 million from Oak Investment Partners, which was quite a bit of money back in the day. In the phase that we were in, we were one of the first guys to raise that kind of money.
So, I mean, you and a new competitor were around about the same time. I don't think he took any money. He scaled everything himself, didn't he?
I'm sorry, I didn't hear the name that you mentioned.
New?
Yeah, that's right. He didn't. He chose a little bit different path. I think he... He was more intent on running the business, himself and without raising money. And, but that's correct, yeah.
So, in hindsight, what do you think were the key benefits you got from having raised the money?
Well, like I said, I think we were able to attract a level of talent that we did not have before. I think we were able to scale the business. So if, you know, you could only afford this month to do a $100,000 buy on Yahoo, but it was profitable, now you have the resources to do a $500,000 buy because you had money in the bank. The venture firms offered us some liquidity. So we were able to take some cash off the table, which played a role in our decision. The money got put to good use. It allowed us to get more great people, allowed us to scale the business, and allowed us to do a number of things that we probably wouldn't have been able to do, or it would have taken quite a bit longer to do had we self-funded the entire thing.
Do you think that NetBlue would have reached the scale that it reached funding?
Without funding. You know, it probably would have taken it a bit longer. A bit longer to do, but I think we probably would have gotten there eventually, sure. And you know, a useful example of someone who I think rivaled us in terms of size, but Versal did it self-funded. So I'd like to think that it was good and new and useful, so I think it probably would have gotten there over time.
Alright. And so, I'm really interested in, as you took the money in, and then you're able to start doing these $500,000 buys through Yahoo and some of these others, did the useful look at that, I mean, are they like, oh man, these guys in Silicon Valley are kicking our ass, or, were you able to go and pick them out a lot of stuff? Did it make a big noticeable difference to the need and scale that you got at that time?
Well, it's a real great question. I mean, I think in hindsight, it did good and it did bad. In other words, you know, what it allowed Nuna to do was probably, more visibly see what we were doing and copy us. Thing that I think that any company that struggles past 10 or 20 people faces is that you at some point take your eye off the ball. And this is what I think Nuna was able to do quite well, was he was able to stay intimately involved in business as this thing scaled. So, you know, the challenge in any growing business is taking your eye off the ball and working on other initiatives. I think Nuna was very, very good at seeing what we were doing and being able to take advantage of the fact that, you know, now we had 70 employees. And with that 65th employee that was now in charge of media buying, as good as new, and the answer is no. So, you know, I think we provided a pretty good roadmap for him to copy us and to do quite well. Again, I don't say copying in a negative way. I think we in the direct marketing space look for what works, and if we can find a competitor that does what works, I think we'll be the first ones lined up to try it as well.
So you went from 20 employees to 70 employees in a pretty short period of time after you got funded, is that right?
Yeah, that's right. So, you know, rather than looking at the minutia of successful media buying, your attention turned to hiring and HR policy and, you know, any number of small things that burden down entrepreneurs as they scale a business. And so that's, you know, again, it's a good thing, it's a bad thing, right?
You actually had to spend time figuring out HR policies.
I'm sorry?
You actually had to spend time figuring out HR policies.
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, you scale a company to a sufficient size and or you take money from a third party, and they in essence become your partners because they now own part of your company. You begin to create the company as they'd like to have it set up, which is, I guess, standard in many, many of these examples. So, you know, you begin to create companies that venture capitalists find are either easy to sell or fit their model or, standardizing quite a bit. So, you know, rather than doing more media buying, perhaps you're buying an HR manager and you're doing, you're hiring recruiters to actively recruit for you. So you begin to kind of take the shape of, what a venture company wants you to look like. Which is a good thing, not a bad thing.
So they were helping prepare you to be sold and grooming the company in a way so that if you're going to be sold or you're going to IPO or whatever's going to happen, that you're set up and you have all things already in place.
That's right. So I think, you know, we probably, for the first time in our history, we're audited. You know, when you run a small business and you're running in this space, you don't think too much about financials outside of are we making money or not. So we began to, you know, organize our books a lot differently. We had accountants and financial planners and CTOs and CFOs and start to organize our books in such a way that became industry standard or became more palatable to someone who wants to buy you. So a lot of time spent on changing not just the culture of the company, because you've now gone from, you know, you may know everyone intimately and friends and everyone there to somebody at 70 where, you know, you don't know everybody and things are moving pretty quickly. So a lot of scaling a company is really difficult because entrepreneurs spend an awful lot of time in areas that, you know, they may not be good at number one, but number two, they don't like to do.
That was one of the other key benefits there. The money came in and it helped get the company groomed to be sold.
Yeah, and I don't think you don't obviously do the company to get sold. I mean, I think that's the first thing to talk about. But I think, you know, you do begin to create a company that that looks like any other great company and is standardized and so people understand what they're dealing with.
And so did that then? You mentioned about focusing. Do you feel that defocused the company once you brought the money in?
Oh, no question. I mean, that's, you know, it's definitely not a unique problem, but no question. I mean, I mentioned earlier, I believe that's how really useful to be able to collect effectively with us because you do lose focus. Again, rather than staring at spreadsheets all day and figuring out click through differences on a particular campaign with a placement, you know, you spend time hiring the people or you spend time in meetings with boards or trying to, you know, report numbers and such. So it is terribly, it does disfocus you. And all you can hope for is that you can train a set of people underneath you that think and act and do what you do or have done successful to get to that point. And in some cases you're able to, in some cases you're not, but it does require an awful lot of work to be able to scale past yourself.
But that, I mean, that sort of stuff at the same time is also good, isn't it? I mean, a lot of companies have successfully come out of Silicon Valley. They have a system in place for growing companies, but it can't be all bad.
No, it's great. When it's done right, you get to scale in ways that your competitors can't help to scale. You begin to build defensibility. You begin to get the great things about, you know, a quickly growing company that you don't get if you're two guys in a bedroom. So when done correctly, absolutely, it makes, you know, a ton of sense. And, you know, companies, successful companies have done it for long before, before we did. So, yeah, by all means, if you do it well, you do it right, you definitely reap the benefits of it.
And so, in hindsight, would you still take money or no money at all, or would you maybe take a smaller amount, like 5 million instead of 20?
Boy, that's a great question. I think, let me just say this, I think at the time we did it, made the most sense. You know, what I do it today, hard to say, you know, really, really hard to say. I don't like to second guess these things, but at the time we made the decision, I think we all felt comfortable that it was the right thing to do. In hindsight, I can't say, well, I don't know whether I did it again or not.
All right. So now we talked a little bit about what you went through in getting funding. I mean, do you want to tell us a little bit about how someone does go out and get funding? I mean, in this case, you had guys coming to you. Let's say if you're a startup or you've got things going reasonably well, revenues are working, and the company's decided that they really do want more money, they made a decision that they do want money to grow faster, how should they go about raising it?
Well, I mean, I guess your first point is what I said initially is that, you know, focus on building a great company, number one, which you've kind of just hit on. I mean, you've got to basically build them something that is of interest, and it tends to revolve around being able to tell a big story around data in a particular vertical that happens to be growing, and you've got revenues attached to it, and you're profitable. I mean, these are the basics, I think, you need to do before you can actually look seriously about raising money, in my opinion, or at least raising money in a manner that protects the entrepreneur's interest. You know, I think once you've done that, there is really no shortage of ways you can go. I mean, there are, sure, venture guys everywhere. It's sometimes as simple as picking up a phone and setting up a meeting. There are investment banks that will represent you and shop your deal around. I even understand there's good ways you can do that online. A friend of mine was showing me a website that unfortunately escapes me now, which lists internet businesses for sale. The range of $3 to $5 million. There's really no shortage of money out there. It really comes down to what you think the money is going to be used for, what you want to do with it, and how you think it's going to affect your business. So, you know, boy, just lots of ways to go for money. It really depends on kind of what you want to do with it and the types of people that you feel comfortable working with, the types of conditions that you think are appropriate for you or your partner, types of things.
So what would you look for? Let's say you want to raise 5 or 10 million. What do you look for in a VC? You look for a match in terms of the style of the VC and the kinds of investments they have. You look for a personality match. What kind of things would be red flags for you that would make you say, hey, these are not the right guys, even though they're offering some money, we're not going to take it?
I think if they didn't have a history in the sector would be the first thing. I mean, if they're a bank that does, or there's a venture fund that does biotech deals and solar energy, and you're in the lead gen space, that would be a big red flag for you. I think, you know, personality-wise, are these people that you feel understand the space? Maybe not as good as you, but certainly understand and appreciate the space and the dynamic nature of it would be the second thing. You know, is the investment either too big or too large for them? Are they making, you know, an investment of $5 million when their normal deal size is $100 million? And, you know, once the ink is dry, you'll never see that venture capital again. Or conversely, are you a huge play for them? So does your deal look like deals they've done in the past would be something I'd look for as well. You know, maybe even past successes is a venture firm that has shown over time they can shepherd entrepreneurs into selling a company or going public or eliciting some type of liquidity event. So, you know, any number of things I think one ought to consider when raising money. I mean, when you raise money, you basically, somebody hops in bed with you and they're your new partner. So, you know, I would just say choose that partner well because that will dictate to some degree the success of your company.
All right. Anything else you want to add on the topic of raising money? I mean, I know it's a topic you know a lot about. I'm trying to think of things to ask you that are good questions.
Yeah, I you know, that's kind of you, David. I don't know that I know a lot about it. I've been a part of seeing money being raised for a couple different companies, and, you know, I was a part of money being raised, you know, very recently. But, you know, it can take your time. I mean, it's a big decision to make. It's a lifestyle decision. Do you want to have 100 employees, or are you pretty happy with 10? Do you want to have board meetings where you're, you know, basically reporting financials? Or do you want to, you know, run out of equipment and not worry about it? So it's an important decision to make. I would just say that if you're blessed with having a successful, profitable company, it's a good problem to have. I'd say approach it carefully.
Because maybe that kind of also illustrates an interesting difference between you and some other companies. You mentioned examples of people being late sending checks and you getting checks for like $1 million that were, you know, it sounded like some of the other companies in the space were a little disorganized, whereas I guess you guys got very corporate and organized and on top of all that stuff.
Yeah, we sure did. I mean, we definitely got a lot more corporate, which,
you know, I don't know if it's a good thing or a bad thing.
It's going to take them a smile out of it. I think so. I mean, we, a lot of fun, crazy stuff going on when you're a small company. We would get checks, you know, I gave you the story earlier, being a check for, I think about $750,000 from a particular partner that was written as his mother's checking account. So, I mean, really fun, weird stories like that tend to slowly disappear as you begin to get more corporate and you begin to standardize a lot of this stuff.
Did you find that that changed? Did you work, like, did your work hours decrease as it became less fun?
I'm sorry, did you repeat that?
Did that change how you approached work? I mean, did you work less hours as you became more corporate like that?
No, I don't think so. I think just the role changed. You know, like, I think that the roles just changed. I think you maybe even work even harder, to be honest, because, you know, you've made a bigger bet. You've really, the pressure's on at that point because, you know, no longer is it you and your few partners that you have to please. You've got outside money that you have to please. So I think if anything, it probably ups the ante a little bit and makes it, you know, that much more stressful, to be honest. And so I think it definitely, that was the case with what we did, for sure.
Did things like dress codes change? Did you have, like, were you coming to work in t-shirt and jeans and then all this became like suits and stuff?
You know, I don't think that was the case. I mean, it is still Silicon Valley, you know, for God's sake, and that didn't change a whole lot. Did it get a little bit more corporate? Sure it did. No question about it, but, you know, I mean, could you wear a flip-flop and t-shirt and shorts? Probably not. But you could certainly wear, you know, jeans and a t-shirt and you wouldn't get too many strange looks. So the effect is not a lot of that changed. But sure, over time, it's a little bit, you know, tiring. You know, we had to formalize sexual harassment training, and you get these different types of training that you have to be a part of, and that was like great and fun, but just one thing that has to happen.
Right. And so how long were you guys running before you got funding?
Boy, I think we were probably going for at least, I'm trying to think back, a year or two before we actually took money.
And what were your revenues before, and then what were your revenues, like, you know, a year before and then a year after?
Trying to think if I recall the amounts. I mean, we showed pretty steady and consistent growth, you know, not just before, you know, we took money, but afterwards. So, you know, but I would just say that, you know, the time that we started versus the time that, you know, we left, we showed pretty consistent growth in revenue. Yeah, we'll see with that. I don't know the exact amounts, but I do know that we were able to successfully continue to grow the company.
Yeah, I mean, was there a big upward spike after you took the money that you were able to grow more quickly, or did the growth slow? What kind of...
You know, I don't know if it's been slow. No, I think it kind of just steadily rose. It rose, you know, steadily. It didn't rise dramatically for the reasons we spoke about. At some point, it rose because we were able to scale more. You know, maybe it declined a little bit, or profit declined because we were able to focus on other areas of the business. So I wouldn't say that with explosive growth as a result of raising money, but it does some things for you that, you know, I think are important. So, no, I wouldn't say the revenues, you know, changed all that much. The revenues may have gone up, the profit go up. Maybe not, because you've hired more people. So I can't say that there was really a dramatic difference that we saw of just raising money. You know what I mean?
All right. Any points you want to add in on either of the topics of getting that blue going or raising money?
No, I think if you're lucky enough to be a part of either starting a great company in the space or raising money, you've succeeded. I mean, you've done what most people will never do in their lives or their careers. So I think you gotta take a lot of pride in that. I mean, it's a lot of work and some hardship, but if you're able to do that, I commend you, because it's not easy.
Okay. All right. So then the next topic I'd like to pick your brain on a little bit is buying companies or buying into companies. And you've, in our conversations offline, you've expressed some strong opinions in that area that there's a lot of opportunity there. You want to maybe talk a little bit about that?
Yeah, I think the current state of affairs with types of companies is it's a very disjointed marketplace. It's, you know, I think a lot of companies are wondering what to do. I think that, you know, I think there are a lot of undervalued assets out there, people that are running very successful companies. And I think it's a great time. I think, you know, maybe a contrarian view. Some people think that Google's won and the ad space is still hot or not hot. But I think if you look around, there are a lot of companies doing very interesting things. There continue to be a lot of M&A activity in the space and people raising money. And I think that just proves the fact that there's a lot of assets out there that were either overlooked or people don't really pay attention to. So I think there's a lot of opportunity out there if this is the space that you want to stay in.
So what do you mean by overlooked? In real estate, you can say a property's been let run down and you can go in and paint the walls and fix a roof and mow the lawn and turn around and sell it. It's obviously not the same with websites. So what do you mean by turning it around or overlooked?
Well, I think a lot of times you can look at a company, and if you've got experience in the space, probably pick up 10 or 20 things you could do differently that would raise revenue. I think, you know, if you could find some people that are willing to work hard, and you've got the basis of a good company, I think, you know, if you come from having experience or seeing things that have worked in the past, I don't think it's very dissimilar to real estate. I think you go in, you paint the walls, you check out the neighborhood, you do a lot of things that you probably do with real estate that would be able to make the company look more interesting than when you first got there. So I don't know that it's very dissimilar to any undervalued asset that you come across, whether it be in business or any other facet, that you would just figure out what needs to get fixed, and assuming you have the tools to do so, you would just go out and start doing it. Go ahead.
An example might be, as your skill is, or one of your skills is buying CPM, you could go and look at companies that aren't doing either not doing that at all or aren't doing a very good job with it, and you could go in and buy them or invest in them and then go and start buying media properly for them.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I mean, a lot of times, you know, people don't know what they don't know. In other words, you get caught up in a certain way of doing things with your business, and you've only known that way. And when you can come from a different perspective on things and realize there's lots of different ways to do it, you can immediately add value because the people that you're buying it from have never seen it that way. And I just been fortunate enough to see things done in very interesting ways, and immediately see like apply the same principles to businesses that I think they can work a lot more money than they are today. So I think that's kind of what I'm speaking about.
That's interesting. And you've gone and basically done this with your own money. Do you want to talk about the investment you made?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, I've more recently got involved with a company that I think fits the profile that is of great interest to me. It's a company that's been around for a while, LuckySurf. And, you know, I've been able to take resources and invest in that. And I'm seeing if I'm right. And I hope I am because, you know, a lot of time, investment money goes into making these things work. And so I'm trying to find, I found an asset that is undervalued that I can take my expertise and make something better than it was when I found it. And so, you know, I'm testing the theory right now. And it's you know, it's a humbling experience. The revenues are not lousy, too, but they're a profitable company and exhibit a lot of the things that I think are important in a company that ultimately becomes something greater than what it is right now. So I've been involved now for about 3 months in an operational level, and I think we're making a lot of really great progress in making the company something better than it was when I found it.
Have you taken it through sexual harassment training yet?
No, not quite yet. We're doing things like formatting spreadsheets and changing macros on spreadsheets and really fun and exciting stuff like that. I hope I never have to be built in that training again.
Yeah, I mean, the way you're describing that before, it sounds like an episode of the TV show The Office.
Yeah, no doubt. You know, no doubt. It's pretty interesting stuff. I don't think I think we enjoy it.
So in terms of this, in LuckySurf, in terms of the investment you've made in LuckySurf and you've come on, I guess, are you a CEO now?
Yes, there's two divisions. There's a interactive division, and there's a publishing division. And so Danielle Lori, the gentleman I've known for years and years, that started the business LuckySurf for 99, is now focused on the agency business, which is doing quite well, and I'm now CEO of the publishing business. And those are really a collection of assets that have been built up to this point. So I'm taking over a lot of great work that Danielle has done for this. They're trying to make it something bigger than it is.
And so when you were looking around for companies, is that what you're looking for, companies you could help them buy media? Or what was it, if you can, I mean, tell me if you can, obviously, and if you can't, no problem, but what was the profile of undervalued companies that you were looking for that you felt like you sort of fit the profile?
Well, I think the first and foremost thing is it a profitable company? I mean, or if it's not, do you have specific plans in place to make it profitable in a short amount of time? And so the biggest thing that I thought LuckySurf is the fact that it's gone through quite a bit in the space and the time it's been doing, to remain profitable, which I think is 90% there to find that particular quality. You know, so that was probably the first thing that interested me in it. And for me, it's really a challenge. I've always, either been an employee somewhere or had plans to start something with people. And I've never really taken something over from somebody. And so I wanted to take that on as a challenge professionally to see if I can take something that, has a certain profile, profitable, but small, maybe struggling. And it seemed like a fun challenge for me to take something and make it bigger than it is. And take this asset that's been not doing a whole lot over the years and see if I can apply right now and make it better. And hope I'm right. I could be wrong, but I'm hoping that at the end of it, I'm right.
Well, I guess we'll check back in 6 months or a year and we'll find out.
Yeah, I think we will.
Cool. Is there anything else then on buying companies you'd like to talk about? How do you do it and make sure that the money goes in the right place? Obviously, in your instance, you stepped in. You haven't been an investor. You're investing, but you're investing and managing your own money. So therefore, you're controlling the sand, aren't you?
Yeah, I mean, no, I think that you proceed with caution. You look at the team. You try to structure it in a way that makes sure there's no ambiguity in the deal. You do all your homework to make sure that what you're buying is what you think it is, and that the initial investors feel good about your involvement there, and they'll be behind you. And so I think that's how you proceed.
So I was talking with one of my friends about this topic, actually, of investing, and his comment was, that it can be, he likes real estate because when you buy real estate, you're buying something, you actually have something to hold, and you can see that over time in general, real estate's a pretty solid investment. But investing in something like an internet company, I mean, who knows, guys might be just out there drinking bottles of Dom Perignon.
Well, I totally disagree with that assessment. I mean, real estate is I would just say that it's what you buy at. I mean, real estate can be a great business, buy at the right price. I think, if you buy at a wrong price, real estate can be an absolutely horrific investment, as many people are finding out right now. So I think the same applies to any business. I mean, it's what you buy it at. It's what you're buying and the price you're buying it at. That can be, equally, if not much more lucrative than real estate. With real estate, you've got tenants. So you got to deal with tenants. I mean, I guess there's no easy answer. There's no easy way to come up with a great investment strategy. I think it's all about finding what works for you, whether it is real estate or it's stocks or bonds or running companies. For me, I think running companies and being involved in the space that I love is far more interesting than real estate. So I guess it's, keeps around.
All right. Do you have any points that you'd like to add in closing or anything else we should talk about?
No, I think hopefully I've been able to hopefully give people my perspective on things. It could be right, it could be wrong. It's my perspective. As always, Aiden, I appreciate the time and the effort you spend on this. So, it's probably good for you.
Cool. Well, thank you very much, Scott.
Okay, take care.